Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the APS Portfolio Strategy Call, The Market Impact of Fed Interventions. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy. Since March 3rd, if you count changes to Fed funds and the start of new QE, the Fed has launched 14 new programs to stabilize markets. It has covered a wide set of assets, some right out of the 2008 playbook. That includes Treasury and agency MBS, dollar swap lines with foreign central banks, liquidity facilities for primary dealers, commercial paper, money market funds, and ABS. Some interventions are new to this episode. That includes agency CMBS, liquidity facilities for primary and secondary corporate debt, muni debt, and the Main Street loan facilities that will lend directly to a targeted set of businesses. The Fed portfolio has gone from $2.4 trillion in early March to $6.1 trillion as of last week, and it looks likely to be heading somewhere between $10 and $12 trillion before at least this first phase is over. We now operate, at least for practical purposes, in a managed market with the Fed setting the boundaries. So understanding how they are operating and their impact is critical. I'm joined today by five of my colleagues, along with Stephen Stanley, our chief economist, to talk about what the Fed has done and the impact, both expected and in some cases unexpected. The group includes Paul Murphy, head of rates trading, Kabir Vadera, head of agency pass-through trading, Adam Broman, head of CMBS trading, Michael Tropiano, head of corporate debt trading, and Zob Negroni, co-head of funding. As we go through each market, just remember you can use the chat box on your webinar screen in the lower right corner to ask questions. You can ask them during the presentations, although we are going to save questions and address them to the speakers at the end. And then we will go to an open Q&A. So with that, let me turn to Paul Murphy and have him talk about what we've seen in the rates market. Paul?
Thanks, Steve. I guess in a five-minute window here, I'm going to break. I think we're all going to break it up into three main segments that we want to address. Number one would be just a broad recap or history of what the Fed has done or Treasury has done in each specific sector. Number one, and number two would be the broader effects on the market. And then thirdly would be unintended consequences, which is a little bit harder to pin down, but something we have to kind of look at. So for broad backdrop, the specifics of the program, after a week of extreme volatility in the rate markets around March 13th, when tens touched the 31 basis point level, the Fed announced a snap Treasury buyback in the Treasury market, where they essentially pushed forward. Excuse me, 1 second. Where they essentially pushed forward their entire month's buyback into 1 day on Friday, the 12th. The ensuing weekend had the emergency Fed meeting where the Treasury and Fed announced a 50 basis point rate cut, but also announced that they would purchase $500 billion worth of Treasuries in the ensuing months. At this point, they've purchased $1.25 trillion in treasuries, which is obviously bigger than initially anticipated, but it's had some pretty good effects on the market. I'll go through the general effects that we've seen for the most part in two different proxies for the market. Number one, off-thorn performance. The number one concern really for the Fed and the Treasury going into coming out of the extreme volatility was off-thorn cheapening versus benchmarks and really extreme illiquidity. So number one, as a proxy, the 8.5-year part of the curve, if you looked at it versus 7s and 10s, its recent benchmarks had cheapened up somewhere around 9 basis points. and has, since they started the program, almost fully recovered that back to pre-buyback levels, which is a pretty significant move considering how quickly the off-the-run sector became pretty dysfunctional. It was probably on par with what we saw in 2008 financial crisis. The overall breadth and scope of the move in 2008 and 2009 in the deeper off-throns was probably more significant. But I would say for the most part, the speed in which we saw this move in the treasury market this time and off-thron liquidity was pretty severe. So that is effect number one, which I think has been pretty successful for the Fed. Number two has been bid offer spreads. No doubt that was as alarming as anything else for the Fed. I think the bond sector was the number one concern as an idea for where we went from that. Initially heading into the program, we had a 1 basis point bid offer spread in the deeper off-the-run 30-year sector. That widened out to 12 basis points at the height, which is only a couple weeks ago. 12 basis points for a point of reference is almost 3 points in the 30-year sector. So pretty hearty move there. That is now corrected back to 5 basis points. So not a total correction in that space, but certainly a pretty good correction. It's important to note, I think, that we're not going to fully get all that liquidity back, or I shouldn't say liquidity, but bid offered spread, as long as we're in the markets we're in with the volatility and risk assets, and as long as we continue to collapse towards zero in rates, you're going to have a wider bid offer spread in that market. So, I think I think it's still a pretty good success story on that front. Overall, I think the other main objective for the Fed was really getting clients, investors, and dealers to reengage in the market, and I think we've seen significant improvement along those lines. We've seen heavy involvement in these programs from our real money account base as well as our leverage accounts. There's obviously been a significant deleveraging in this process. And I think we're starting to see a lot more stability. And really in the last 5 days is a good proxy, average intraday moves in the belly of the curve are averaging 4 or 5 basis points where we had seen some, near 15 or 20 basis point moves really in the heat of the crisis. So I think commitment of capital from clients has been significantly improved over the last couple of weeks, and I think that's once again a success story. Last thing to recap is the unintended consequences. As I said before, pretty hard to pin down, but I think you could argue that a move to zero and a collapse to zero in rates, which is certainly possibly where the Fed's heading, collapses a lot of RV opportunities in the market, and I think that disengages a lot of capital. Leverage community and their participation in the market, I think, is pretty important. So I think that's something we have to keep on that potentially could be lost. Number two is the obvious one, which I think, I'll leave the economists and the macro theories to look at, but is this obviously all these programs inflationary for the market, and what does it really mean for the long end of the curve if we have so much macro fiscal and monetary stimulus being thrown at the market. And last but not least, we're obviously going to have a ton of supply that we have to contend with starting in May, where we have a new 20-year coming in. And they're going to have to push the supply numbers out the coupon curve. The Fed artificially suppressing rates ahead of that and tapering their program into that, and then suddenly throwing a lot of coupon supply at the market as we come out of it. There's probably a harbinger for a little more volatility in the market, which I think the Fed is really trying to tamp down. So I think potential long end volatility and curve volatility is probably something that we need to keep an eye on as we look into the summer months.
Okay, Paul, thanks so much. Let's go from the Treasury and rates markets into pass-throughs and Kabir Vidara. Kabir, what's been the story of the Fed there?
Good morning, rather good afternoon, everyone. Just like Paul started, I'm just going to go through some numbers of what the Fed's done so far, and then just go through the implications. And then towards the end, we'll talk a little about prepayments and how the forbearance policy is affecting prepayments or can potentially affect prepayments in both conventionals and in Ginnie Mae's. So just from the beginning, right, I mean, before the Fed involvement, because of massive originator selling that led to a pretty significant decline in mortgage dollar prices that in turn led to some pretty significant deleveraging from the REITs based on margin calls. So mortgages widened out to some historically wide levels. Now, the different ways to measure kind of how wide or tight mortgages are, but what we try to look at is just a current coupon versus a blend of fives, tens, and that has the advantage of taking out any kind of model noise from it. So before the Fed got in, on our metric, and you can look at that in Bloomberg as well, briefly, current coupon versus an average of 5-10s treasury yields was 180 basis points wide, which is, obviously, talking about financial crisis levels. Once the Fed announced QE4, that's after some noise, the spread is kind of stabilized between 120 and 140 basis points. So while mortgages are still cheaper than their pre-COVID-induced crisis levels, they have come in a significant amount. And I think what's incredible is like the amount of buying that Fed has already that's already gone through the system. So just to give you some really quick rundown, right? The week number one, they bought $67 billion. Week number two, they bought $183 billion. Week three, $112. Week four, $82. And week five, which is you're talking about $25 billion. So I think weeks two and three were obviously highly elevated because that's when the market needed most support. That's when the bulk of the REIT deleveraging was taking place. And once that was out of the way, we saw days of like relentless tightening. And I think once we kind of stabilized, once the margin call pressure on the REITs abated, once their book value stabilized, once their stock price stabilized, I think the Fed support also kind of the velocity of the purchases and the volume of the purchases obviously slowed down. So we have gone from a peak of $183 billion to last week of $82, and this week the max is going to be $75 because they're buying $15 billion a day, and quite likely that number keeps going lower as asset prices somewhat normalize. What do I think about the market going forward? I think, unfortunately, for me as a spec pool trader, for a while I thought that the Fed's actions went a little bit too well. And what I mean by that is they were actually having the intended effect, i.e., we saw massive money manager selling off of stories across the board, generic to season stories, anything with QSIP, to raise cash to buy resi or high yield or IG or basically any other asset class that had significantly lagged the move in agency MBS. The widening of the last few days, we view that as a very, very healthy move. But I would caveat that with that balance sheet across the street is still extremely, extremely scarce. You saw how rolls traded very poorly this cycle, and we expect rolls to be weak next cycle as well, despite the significant Fed takeout. I think right now, there's no problem funding bonds and repo. Funding is freely available, but the demand for funding obviously is down since a lot of QSIPs have been. It's tough for guys to add QSIPs given balance sheet constraints. We expect spreads to be in these levels for the near future, give or take 10 basis points. I really don't have a strong view there. I think the big question for us and what we're really grappling with is twofold. Number one, what's the through-the-box CTD going to look like given all the Fed takeout and given projected speeds? And projected speeds also have a ton of moving parts given the refi index has not come down as much as the purchase index, and originators are having issues obviously hedging their pipeline. Just give liquidity for their TBA for providing them TBA liquidity has obviously come down a lot, because what happened was with the market rallying 2-3 points on Fannie 2.5s, they were inundated with margin calls. So the exact opposite of what happened to the REITs happened to the mortgage originators. In the market rally, there were short bunch of the street, and there was a lot of cash outlays they had to make to meet the margin calls. So that's obviously impeded their ability to close loans. So you've got decreased originator liquidity. You've got, obviously, COVID-induced shutdowns. Purchase activity has plummeted, and now you've got potential forbearance that has the ability to slow down prepay significantly over the next 12 months, and a lot more so in Ginnies. But then what happens after the 12-month window? Do we get buyouts, or do these things self-cure? So there's a lot of moving parts, and we don't have all the answers, but some of the issues that we're grappling with. Our sense is that just given the composition of the Ginnie Mae borrower, you should have a much more dramatic impact on Ginnie Mae prepays than conventional prepays, where Fannie Freddie at least are kind of controlling things. Ginnie's is obviously a bit of a question mark, and what makes Ginnie's even more tough is that the services being forced to advance the P&I are significantly less capitalized than the agencies, all non-bank servicers. So those are kind of, the issues in the market right now is basically you're talking about projected prepayments. We are talking about what's the CTD going to look like after the Fed cleans out a lot of the fast being measure and multi-pools, and how do we shake out versus other spread product. Obviously, the Fed's buying IG. They're buying high yield. So the tightening we've seen in a lot of those asset classes, it'll be a healthy move for agency MBS because for a couple of weeks we're just nonstop selling mortgages to buy other stuff. So that's definitely a beta to an extent, but we still feel there's a lot more of that trade to happen. So that's it from me. I'm happy to take any questions at the end of the call. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Kabir. Now we're going to move on to the first of at least two areas where the Fed is getting involved, at least for outside of its 2008 playbook, and we're going to start with agency CMBS, and at this point, other parts potentially of CMBS, and that trading is run by Adam Broman. Adam?
Hey, Steve. Thank you very much, and appreciate everybody hopping on this call this afternoon. I would like to thank the Fed for inviting us to the table to enjoy this party. It's been extremely helpful for our market and something that is, as Steve mentioned, is new to us. So on March 23rd, the Federal Reserve announced that it would start buying agency CMBS via the open market operations. That was a very good time for them to announce it. Spreads in the agency CMBS market were at their recent wides at that point. We were approximately 125 basis points wide of the recent tights that we had seen in January, February. We had also had many accounts, specifically levered accounts like REITs, having tough times meeting margin calls, and there was definitely some headlines that we saw around that. So with that announcement, it was pretty broad, and there weren't too many specific details. However, it did help ease fears and help stabilize spreads. By the time that the Fed did do their first purchase program on March 27th, we saw spreads of approximately 100 basis points tighter before that auction even went off. And since that first purchase, with a little bit more clarity, the Fed has been buying across all three sectors, Fannie Mae DUS, Freddie Mac K-Series, and Ginnie Mae Project loans on a weekly basis. The Fed has announced a max so far of $7 billion. Of that, $6 billion has been filled. 100% of the Fannie Mae DUS pools and the Ginnie Mae Project loans have been filled. But I think the one thing to note is that of the Freddie purchase program, only 32% of the intended purchases were actually made. So what does this mean, and what has it done for our sector in general? Similar to what I heard Murph say and some other guys, it definitely helped bring stability back to our markets. When things got at their really widest points, we saw a bid ask go from something that historically been, call it 2 to 10 basis point markets, depending on product, to being Freddie K's and 10 on the project loan side. We saw that go as wide as 25 to 50 basis points, which is not surprising just given how volatile the markets were. That has come back a lot, I think mostly in the K market. You can see just given how lack of buying there is, given how stable those markets are, and DUS, and to the Ginnie Mae project loan market, which has only seen one purchase so far, but there will be another one this week, which will help clear out some more of the paper that's been sitting around. note, a lot of the bonds that were taken out of the market by the Fed so far has been less liquid bonds. So we're talking about mostly Fannie Mae dust pools, given that has been the broad purchases by the Fed, $4.5 billion total out of the $6 billion. So things that really were illiquid, such as, you know, single loans with high premiums, non-standard products such as credit facilities, student, and other issues. Those are things that were sitting around a guy's balance sheet that had trouble moving. So what they've done is they've helped clear all that, and it's allowed for accounts to redeploy assets, cash into new assets. We've seen that so far in the past 2 weeks. There have been two new deals in the market since we've hit our wides. There was a Fannie Mae GEMS deal last week. Their price at swap was 67 for a 10-year. Freddie Mac is in the market this week with a $1 billion 10-year deal. That was 64.65. That was off the wide that they had printed in end of February at 90. So the markets have really been acting a lot more like we're used to seeing them. One thing that we do know, though, is just given the shutdown in a lot of the markets around us, specifically the housing market and the multifamily market, supply, new issue supply has been low, and we're not surprised that what we're seeing now are these deals going very quickly. These deals are 3 to 6 times oversubscribed. It's bringing back our traditional bank buyer, who has been a big buyer of the sector in the past 2 years, looking to add some positive convexity to their portfolio. And, you know, with the rally that we had seen, it really kept guys out of the market. With that being said, with the new issue stuff, they're seeing stuff in their $103 price range and really scooping this up as much as they can. Supply has been really low for us, and with the Fed taking more out, it just will continue to tighten pricing on the follow. With that being said, you know, we'll continue to see them. We expect to see the Fed continue to buy as long as, you know, the markets are out there. They have been mostly sticking to what we call sort of on the run paper. 10 years historically for the K's with the, you know, 9.5 years of defeasance. On the dust side, they did go a little bit broader, 10-year maturity to as long as 30-year maturity, as long as it did have a six-month yield maintenance window, which is why we've seen more purchasing there. I think there is some room for the Fed to come in and broaden that. You know, one of the consequences that we are seeing is more off-the-run stuff, such as callable 10-7s, single asset, single borrower names, that do not have the Fed buying wind out. So that basis that we've normally seen has definitely widened. One of the other unintended consequences that we've seen has really been on the Freddie side. What they've done is the Fed has, in essence, pushed credit risk from the capital, from the private markets back to the government. So in their last two deals, Freddie Mac has traditionally wrapped their deals down to 14 to 15% to 100 slice, and there's been a mezz class and a first loss class, and what they've done is they've actually wrapped down to the mezz class. So they're now wrapping down to 7.5%. So they put that risk back on the GSEs. They're now wrapping a little bit lower, and you know, that's just because spreads have tightened on the top of the curve. That being said, I think, you know, it's a temporary fix. I think if TALF and other programs could help on the non-guaranteed side, I think you could see that go back to your normal guaranteed mezz and first loss class. With that being said, you know, we continue to hope to see the Fed weekly. I think, obviously, as you see the numbers come down like we have in the K-series, we can definitely see that maybe them slowing down on that and continuing to do more Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae until we see those numbers also fall off. But overall, it's been very positive for our market, and we're, you know, not quite back, but we feel like we're in a very comfortable place where markets are acting very efficiently right now. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, thanks, Adam. Let's go to the second market where the Fed is really at least attempting to be involved for the first time, and that's corporate credit. That desk is run by Mike Tropiano. Mike, you want to tell us what you're seeing?
Hello, everyone. This is Mike Tropiano here. you know, it's hard to say how the program's going to go since the Fed hasn't really been clear as far as how they're going to go forward. But, you know, prior to the Fed announcement on March 22nd of the buyback program, credit spreads were at their widest. You know, we had CDX and LQD, the ETF, you know, were trading at lows that were not seen going back to the oil sell-off in February of 2016. You know, the credit spread curve had inverted and demand in the short-term maturities really dissipated. You know, the initial announcement stated the Fed would participate in both primary and secondary markets, triple B or better, going out no further than 5 years, 4 years for primary for issuers headquartered in the United States. The secondary program would include the IG ETFs. They included a cap of 10% of issuer maximum of the issuer's maximum bonds outstanding on any day between the day of the announcement on March 22nd out 1 year. It also included language for any industry that is expected to receive direct assistance from the aid bill. They've indicated the program would be approximately $700 billion in size. You know, after this announcement, we did see the overall market stabilize and demand in shorter and maturities return to the market. You know, slowly, the credit spread curve has normalized, and in most cases, it's not inverted anymore. If you look at March, the new issue window is $259 billion for credit, and that was a record. And the bonds were taken down by the market quite easily. There was a big appetite there for bonds. So, you know, unfortunately, not much has been said in the interim as far as the process outside of the Fed asking BlockRock to aid as an intermediary in the process. A later update of the term sheet was released on April 9th last week, which expanded the program to include high yield ETFs and fallen angel BB credits that were triple B rated as of the 22nd of March, and to exclude banks. They also stated that primary debt purchases require, you know, 100 basis point concession over the market price for issuers looking to sell directly to the Fed. After this announcement, the market rallied approximately 50 basis points in a matter of a half an hour. You know, accounts are now buyers of 5 years and in. And, you know, since their announcement, you know, it's safe to say that, you know, in certain areas, in certain sectors, the market has rallied between 200 and, you know, up to 350 basis points, depending on the sector. You know, until the Fed actually announces how they're going to proceed, it's kind of difficult to know the procedures that will be in place. But, you know, I do believe that the ECB has already started a similar process, announcing their own $750 billion asset purchase program called PEP, the Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program. You know, likewise, we don't have the details on how the ECB plans to execute the corporate trades. However, you know, they have had a previous purchase program in place called the CSPP, the Corporate Sector Purchase Program, which was initiated in 2016, and it included trades as recently as last year. You know, likely serves as an example of how they'll probably proceed in the future. You know, purchases under that CSPP were executed via bilateral trades with dealer counterparties. These trades were conducted via major electronic platforms and by voice, requesting prices from several counterparties for the same security and then trading at the best price. Since the program began, the ECB has traded with more than 350 counterparties. And it appears, you know, they stayed in the most focused, you know, they focused more on the liquid and newly issued bonds. You know, outside of that, I don't have any more details, but I do believe, you know, we have oil, which has been putting pressure on our markets also, and especially the energy sector, you know, and I believe that has stabilized everything throughout credit, and it's made it a much more healthy market at the time. But I do believe if the Fed does not follow through, it's easy, you know, we will see a reversal of this market stabilization that we've seen over the past 2 to 3 weeks, and we'll probably go out. I think the downside is probably bigger than what we gained. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, thanks, Mike. And let's finally turn to the one thing that really is the underpinning for all of these markets, and that's funding and liquidity. And the Fed has obviously been involved in that part of the market as part of its charter from the beginning, but it's important to stay in touch with it. For that, we'll go to Zav Negroni. Zav?
Good afternoon. Thanks, Steve. And we do genuinely appreciate everybody joining this call, and hopefully it's informative from my perspective, my co-head, Forbes Hopper's perspective, and the rest of the critical team, Russ Felicetti, Mike Cardesi, Mike Eggleston. We want to keep a dialogue open with our relationships. So in a quick nutshell, and I'll try to do this in about 3 minutes, I think from our perspective, when we think of the Fed impact, a lot of the crises, for lack of a better word, that effectively start from high leverage financing disciplines that can't necessarily sustain the leverage, but most importantly, bloated balance sheets. And so the Fed programs and what we look at very closely are programs that are lending through intermediaries and programs that are relieving balance sheet. And without question, there are programs that simply improve the confidence, but more specifically, the programs that specifically provide lending to those that need it, or the programs that provide balance sheet relief are the most effective. And so to that end, we think about the confidence through everything they've done in the open market operations with temporary open market operations. And you can see how that's a moving event going all the way back to September, and most importantly, through the unlimited size and scale, through daily, weekly, biweekly, monthly, and three-month transactions. Through the permanent operations, which are now more in the formal way of buybacks, which Paul Murphy talked about at length. But then more specifically, things that help the balance sheet and the dollar, not the dollar transition, if you will, but the movement of dollars through the banking system to get dollars to those that need it. So the swap lines, which have had substantial usage, $350 billion or so, and then most recently the Fed-FEMA program, which we haven't seen a lot of usage, which is the Fed lending effectively to central banks for their collateral so they don't necessarily have to sell. Those are critical, critical ways to help relieve stress. And then, of course, most specifically, things that directly target balance sheet, like temporary regulatory relief, as they did in a reserve requirement in March, and the exclusion of treasuries and reserves in the supplemental leverage calculation. That's a hundreds of billions of dollars relief to Fed balance, to dealer and to bank balance sheets. And so the impact, I think, as you can imagine, can end up being, it certainly takes us in the direction we'd like, but what you heard loudly is Kabir talk how his balance sheets are so-so, and yet Adam talking about his balance sheets are remarkably better. And I think that's important. And Tropiano, who didn't get a chance to talk about his balance sheets so much because those credit programs haven't really come to full bear. And so what we see in our market is exactly that. Some tattering improvements of balance sheets, some that are some areas that look a little bit better, but nonetheless, the balance sheet premium is still substantial. On a parallel track, we see substantially improving LIBORs, and on an even more parallel track and more direct, measuring the impact of the dollar demand and where it sits through the currency swaps, we're seeing those improve. In terms of measuring unintended consequences, I think first we'll start with the one that's intended, which is pricing iterations and the frequency and volume level with which the Fed has been activist in this conversation. I think we've all remarked how this process, anybody that sat through crises in the 90s, and then, of course, the great financial crisis, remarks the speed and scale with which this one came on, and then, of course, the speed and scale with which the Fed reacted. And what we've appreciated is their iterative nature to seeing something, reacting, realizing they may need to tweak, and tweaking. But unintended, of course, they have done some, I wouldn't say damage, but some interesting impacts to the riskless investment scheme. You see that with Treasury bills trading where they're trading, CM bills trading where they're trading, short coupons and the same, all compared to repo and discount notes. And that's messy, but it's even more messy when you compare those riskless asset classes to, say, anything like high-grade credit repo or the financing of non-agency mortgages, which are LIBOR-based. And so you could see those all pivoting off LIBOR. And although LIBOR is improving, LIBOR OS specifically, it still sits at very, very wide. The forwards tell you, yes, there's compression, but it's not like it was in the last time we had zero interest rate policy. And so that unintended event makes non-traditional funding challenging, and most importantly makes it, through leverage and scale, somewhat limited, at least a lot more limited than it was a short month ago. I will stop there.
Zoff, thanks very much. For the the large number of listeners still on the line, I remind you that you can submit questions using your webinar browser with a feature in the lower right side of the screen that allows you to put a question in the chat box. So I'd encourage you to do that if you have questions for our speakers today. In the meantime, there was a question already submitted that is on repo. So Zav, I think this is probably one for you, but a client is asking about the landscape of repo funding for ABS, CMBS, and CLOs, just a little bit of color on haircuts and rates.
You want me to just take a stab?
Fire away.
So, look, I think this ends up being a pretty substantial question and one that, that is best served in a couple of different follow-ups. I think what I'd tell you is during the first financial crisis and immediately following, you had a lot of review of specific assets. And I think the discipline there got, I wouldn't say lazy, but got less targeted. And so you will see people go back to that. You shouldn't see people go back to a world where they're only funding what they sell you, but you should see people do real deep diagnostics on what they're funding. And so the danger of kind of just hitting wholesale asset, hitting asset classes from a wholesale perspective, I think becomes challenging. I think the Fed has set kind of the minimum, if you will, through their primary dealer credit facility and how they're thinking about haircuts, and that's pretty interesting with respect to CMBS and CLO, and a little more fractured with respect to RMBS. And I believe in a couple of days they're going to make public the haircuts that they're providing the dealers for that. But I'll tell you most specifically what we've really found is that from a general perspective, haircuts are up roughly 10% to 15% for anything that's sat in a non-rated scheme, like a legacy position, and anything that is CLO, CMBS, ABS post-2008-9 has probably had less of a change. We think that is logical because it isn't necessarily the challenge of the valuations. It's finding the liquidity. But on the rate side, certainly because of where LIBOR has been setting, both 1 month and 3 month, and the nature of financing, spreads are out on a LIBOR-adjusted basis just substantially, probably three or four times the amount of spread added to certain things. And so think of 100 basis points, 150 basis points as a range. This can get very nuancy depending on the underlying. So let me stop there, and I could certainly try after this call, if anybody has specific questions, to go through their sales coverage, and we can try to get more detail.
Thanks, Av. I have a question for Michael Tropiano, and this is on what one client heard is your comment that if the Fed did back away from corporates at some point, we would potentially retest wides. Was that did we hear you right? And if so, can you elaborate on why you think?
It's my opinion, and I believe that where it'll be felt most is in the high beta sectors such as energy. Even if you look at oil, it's still trading at lows right now, even with the Russia OPEC agreement to cut production. So it's not as if oil's rallied. Like these high beta names in the energy sector, I believe, are getting support from this program that the Fed says, hey, they're going to come in, they're going to support fallen angels, and they're going to make sure that everyone's included in the program. And I believe if they step back, those sectors will get hit the hardest, given where we are with commodity, with the oil prices right now. So I do think there will be a widening of spreads, and it'll be hard. The hardest hit will be the diversified, the independent energy companies and the MLPs. So, and some of the other high beta industrial names out there. But thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Then a question on the agency MBS market, again, coming in for a client. I guess this one for Kabir. Given all the change so far, I'm sure it's difficult to see to the end of the year. But if you take a stab at where you think the mortgage current coupon would be versus the 5-10 blend, where do you see that ending up after all of this plays out for the rest of the calendar?
Yeah, so I think I would obviously, a lot of moving parts out here, but before answering that quantitatively, I would just want to point out that right now, the only takeaway buyer is the Fed. Banks, barring a couple of accounts, have been extremely quiet. I think most of the CMOs that are buying is probably of collateral that a lot of the REITs have sold, so that's not a, they're not like really taking away bonds from the system. I guess they are freeing up some balance sheet for the dealers, but where they're buying bonds, it's impossible to recreate new CMOs. So to the extent that we have new production that we're bidding on in spec pool form, there are no bidders for that. There are no bank bidders. There are no REIT bidders at the moment. So only thing you have are money managers, and they are not going to tighten spreads that dramatically because they're being very, very picky. And, you know, they're obviously, you know, they're obviously looking at it versus other asset classes. So if nothing changes, if the Fed is buying 10, you know, keeps tapering its purchases on a weekly basis, I don't see us, we can probably drift wider. I think what's most likely going to happen is that you're obviously seeing a lot of optimism in obviously equities and credit and other sectors because of Fed buying or because of, you know, there's some kind of a resolution to this whole lockdown. If we somehow get to like normal as far as the kind of activity goes and corporate spreads go tighten and based on fundamentals and commercial real estate spreads tighten based on fundamentals, then I think steady state given normal supply and demand, bank buying based on deposit growth, modest rate buying, I think we'll probably be somewhere between 110 and 120 basis points versus 5-10s. I think that's probably my sense right now with significant uncertainty around that forecast because we've not even gone through like the impact of on spreads of forbearance and buyouts. So you know, you could argue that in 12 months if things haven't gone better, you could have a huge round of buyouts and how that impacts spreads and supply and whatnot. So, but I would say if things kind of return back normal, we should probably be, you know, between 110 and 120 basis points. But again, I could be way off either way.
Okay. Thanks, Kabir. Let me actually swing back to Zav just for a quick opinion on something. Again, a client is now focusing on LIBOR rates, which have been very elevated. They've clearly 3 month, if you're using that as a benchmark, they've come off their highs of a couple of weeks ago, but 3 month is still around 120. The client notes when tier one names are funding 3 months at 50 basis points. So what's keeping LIBOR elevated?
So, you know, certainly never short of opinions, but sensitive to the fact there's a ton of moving parts here that we don't necessarily participate in directly. We trade the short credit book for Mike Tropiano, and he's a phenomenal presence there. But in terms of like the commercial paper market, it's not something that we deal in as a dealer in running programs. The way we've kind of reconciled this is we are literally at a very important crossroads. The CPFF has just started today. The money market liquidity facility started a few weeks ago, and that usage is relatively light, I think, based on people that have reviewed it and thought they would see more size and scale. I think the pricing of these facilities, because this is a little bit of a circular loop and priced 100 over OIS or something in that neighborhood, you end up having LIBOR, I wouldn't say artificially elevated, but certainly elevated. And so that's where we look for things to break and to change. And so, you know, 3 month LIBOR 1 month forward implied at 65, 1 month LIBOR 1 month forward implied at 40. Those are all dramatically better than where we are now. And so the downward trajectory continues. I think it has to happen at a slow pace until so many of this secondary credit and primary credit gets cleaned up. I'll stop there.
Okay. We are getting a question on the leveraged loan market, and I know we don't have our colleagues in CLO trading on the line, but I'll just make one comment on that. I know that the Fed last week opened TALF to static AAA CLO classes, and on the margin that probably will help in some cases. It may bring out additional static CLO deals that might have had marginal economics in the past, but could potentially now get a bid from an audience that feels like it would have a steady and pretty effective source of funds. But it's really not a tremendous source of support for leveraged lending. I think the other thing that's interesting about last Thursday's announcement is the extension of the Main Street facility to borrowers that need loans of up to $150 million and have leverage ratios, at least measured by debt to gross earnings, of up to 6 times. That leverage ratio captures at least a material portion of the leveraged loan market. I believe all leveraged loans issued through the first quarter of this year had an average ratio in the neighborhood of 5 times. So you can see that half, if not 60% of all loans would qualify on the leverage framework. In general, I think the program is going to be healthy for leverage lending. It's going to add some important liquidity there. Even though it might not be able to meet the needs of larger corporations, larger levered corporations, a lot of these middle market or low end of the high BSL market are the suppliers or customers of larger corporations. And so if they're healthier, it should improve the credit of larger players as well. So a plus for levered loans, but we're still expecting to see significant downgrades and substantial real economic damage with some of these highly levered enterprises that are going to presumably have to go forward in a market where consumers just may not have much of an appetite for the products they were selling before. So there's significant risk of downgrade in the loans. We think there's significant risk of downgrade especially in speculative grade and to some degree even lower investment grade CLO debt. So the outlook there is still challenged and will really require careful credit expertise to kind of navigate that part of the market. There's a question here as well, and then we're going to wrap up in a few minutes. Just again, touching it on something in the agency MBS market and focusing specifically on servicers. Servicers now are going to have to advance substantial P&I to loans that are that get forbearance. And a client is asking how long we think non-bank servicers can run without additional funding. Kabir, I don't know if you have a specific timeline, but I know you've been in conversation with servicers about their situation. What are your thoughts there?
Steve, so unfortunately, we've not had any real conversations with these services regarding their cash reserves, but just anecdotally, what we've heard is, and just the way their business model works, they are highly, I would say, working capital efficient, i.e. they have recently thin or very thin working capital buffers. So I cannot imagine these guys having, if they have to advance P&I, I think I'd be shocked if they have reserves of their own past 2 to 3 months. I mean, that might be also on the higher side. I think for them, the way it works is that they typically fund all their loans that have been closed to these warehouse lines. And, you know, in a lot of these guys, even when they put out bonds, they always put them up for short settle because they need the cash as soon as possible. So given how efficiently they run from a cash usage standpoint, the combination of all the margin calls to the MBSD, and I'm sure the margin calls to the warehouse, that you add that to advancing P&I is just going to be without any explicit government support. I mean, I don't see how these guys you can legitimately see in the absence of any support or half-hearted support or any private market capital being put to work, I think these guys are just going to turn the keys to the agencies. There's just no way I see them having, if they're advancing P&I on top of the existing cash or working capital usage, I don't see how these guys survive for more than a couple of months. They just do not have the cash. The business model is just so fundamentally driven by very little working capital, because everything is, you're basically a working capital. You have basically a warehouse for the loans you've not closed, and you sell the loan bunch of the street for early settle. There's cash going in and out, and there's just a very thin buffer of working capital that's kind of left over, especially given that you're working in the agency space. So we haven't had any real conversations, kind of a sensitive topic, but again, given what we know about their business model, don't expect a large kind of ready to funds for unexplained cash outlays is my sense.
Okay, thank you, Kabir. Here's another question on servicing, which I'm happy to field. The client's asking what protection, if any, do servicers have, or what ability, I guess, do they have to put pressure on borrowers that have requested forbearance? What pressure can the servicer put on the borrower to verify their hardship? Well, I can tell you that based on the guidelines in the CARES Act, the only thing that a borrower has to provide is a personal attestation that they have had some kind of hardship due to a COVID-19. And beyond the attestation, which can be very simple, there is no requirement for proof. There's slightly different language as you go between Fannie, Freddie, VA, and FHA, but the most liberal of those is the FHA guidance, which essentially tells servicers that if their borrower calls and asks for forbearance, the servicer must, quote unquote, provide that. So it really is in the hands of the borrowers and not the servicers that are essentially governing the doorway to forbearance. And for that reason, we've actually, from a strategy standpoint and from a data and modeling standpoint, spent a lot of time in the last week trying very quickly to get our hands on the magnitude of uptake of forbearance. We think, as Kabir was mentioning earlier, it's going to have very significant impact on prepayments, potentially very significant impact on buyouts at some distant horizon. And obviously, it will have very significant impact on servicers that have to advance while loans are in forbearance. So the one other question that I'll touch on quickly, again, this is a question about the LIBOR-SOFR spread adjustment. As many of you probably remember, the ARC, Alternative Reference Rate Committee, which is the U.S. committee in charge of the transition to SOFR, has still been active through this crisis and continuing to push that agenda forward. You can even see that in the Fed's definition of funding rates for TALF, they use SOFR as a reference rate. So regulators are still continuing to put that on their agenda. Earlier this year, ARC came out with a proposal that there be a fixed spread between LIBOR and SOFR, and I think based on backward-looking three-year or five-year averages, it was in the neighborhood of 9 basis points. So LIBOR would essentially equal SOFR plus 9. Well, obviously, that spread is a lot wider now, and I think, if anything, this is going to continue to challenge the possibility of a single, smooth, one-time adjustment to current LIBOR contracts as a fair way of adjusting for the new index. My guess is this episode, with the widespreads that we're seeing right now, at times upward of 140 45 basis points between three-month LIBOR and SOFR is going to really sharpen market concerns about how we make that transition. So I don't know if I have an answer, but this episode has put an easy answer probably farther away than it was before. Just looking at our queue, I may have missed a question or two here or there. And for the time being, I'm going to pass on the question of what are each panelist's favorite Nicolas Cage movie. You can contact them directly for that later. But I want to thank everybody that has stuck with us so far for roughly almost coming up on an hour. We hope you get a clear sense of the critical role that the Fed is now playing in really a very, very broad part of fixed income. Going forward, certainly this year and arguably for years to come, if 2008 was any guide, the Fed is going to be a material player and its decisions are going to have material and at times unexpected effects on how assets trade. So we intend to be following that very, very closely. Thanks again for your time. Thanks again for your attention. Be safe, be well, and good luck in the markets. That's it for APS Portfolio Strategy for today.